This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of sustainability issues every week. It's brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. The regular panel of Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher are joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene, politics, science and controversy on Sustainable Lens on Radio, tonight at 7 o'clock, from podcast on www.sustainablelens.org or www.oar.org.nz.
Welcome to Sustainable Lens, an event on radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher, who's not here tonight, because this time I'm in Lancaster, and me, Samuel Mann. I'm with Mike Berners-Lee, the director of Small World Consulting, based at Lancaster University. He is the author of two books, How Bad Are Bananas? The Carbon Footprint of Everything, and The Burning Question, which offers us a big picture perspective on climate change and what we should be doing about it. Thank you for having me.
Pleasure.
How bad are bananas?
Well, they turn out to be, from a carbon perspective, they turn out to be fine because they go on a boat rather than an aeroplane. And but the point of the whole book, How Bad Are Bananas, which it charts the carbon footprint of about 100 or so things, ranging from the very small a text message is the smallest one, I think, to the very large. The largest one is burning the whole of the world's fossil fuels. And it goes through a whole range of just about everything you can think of. And the idea is that although it's only 100 different things, it gives you a sense of what the carbon footprint of almost anything ought to be, roughly speaking, and why. And it's designed to be a fun book, and it's designed to be informative, and it's designed to try to give us an instinct for where the at least with respect to climate change, where the impacts are in our in everything that we do, because that's something which very few of us, well, none of us have, none of us are born with that instinct. We've got this invisible gas, carbon dioxide, and all the other greenhouse gases, and the emissions take place not in front of our eyes in a way we can see, but the emissions behind the things we buy, for example, take place down long distance supply chains that most of the time most of us haven't got a clue about. So it was trying to just open eyes to that, really.
Okay, let's take a few steps back. Where'd you grow up?
In London. And I started off doing a physics degree, for better or worse.
Why?
Partly because it really interested me at school. I used to enjoy it. I found it easy. And it didn't involve writing anything down, which was something that I found very tricky in my school years.
But you've obviously fixed that.
Well, computers have really helped.
Right. Where was that? Where was your physics degree?
I went to Oxford. My degree bored me rigid.
I was going to say, well, what did you think you were going to do with it?
I don't think I'd really thought it through at the time, but I realised as I went through my degree, I realised there was precious little I did want to do with it. I think at the end of the day, my problem is I couldn't really give a monkey's whether the Higgs boson exists, for example. but I'm much more interested in questions about how we live and how people's lives are and how we get on as a global society and stuff like that.
Have you always been interested in that?
Yeah, I have. Yeah, I think so. So that gave me a real crunch when I came to leaving my degree. I ended up, I got a job as an Outward Bound instructor, and that was all about people and how they live and how people live together and how we make the most of our lives and how we think about how we want to spend our time and so on. And that got me into organisation, working in management, and that got me into organisation development. And I did. I worked with all kinds of organisations, with Oxfam, for example, looking at what do they mean by poverty and how what to do about it, but also just ordinary businesses as well. And in the course of organisation development, I started doing strategy work looking at the environmental technologies sector. And one of the things that came out of my work was the finding that, by and large, environmental consultants didn't seem to have the ability to bring about change. They could comment on what needed to be done and they could do audits, but they didn't seem to be able to make the business world or the political world do what the evidence was suggesting might would be a good idea. So after a few years of commenting on that, I thought, well, okay, and with climate change becoming increasingly clear that climate change was going to be a big deal, I thought perhaps I'd better have a go at seeing what I could do with an environmental consultancy focused on climate change. So that was small world.
Is that because the consultants, presumably they're people that get climate change, and you'd like to think that being consultants, they're change agents. What's the breakdown in that?
Well, I think environmental consultants come in all sorts of different breeds. I mean, there's plenty out there who are just commercial consultants doing whatever it will take to make a living by persuading clients that they should spend money on you. And that's a lot of work that goes on to that end. I would say it isn't particularly useful from a sustainability point of view. I think there's also hasn't been enough understanding of all the different perspectives that need taking into account if you're trying to create change. And that's definitely, if you look at the world getting on top of its sustainability issues at the moment, you could certainly argue that we need much more systemic thinking about including, you know, who are all the stakeholders in the world and what really are their worldviews and what kind of things can they and can't they respond to in order to create a model, a realistic model for change, for the kinds of change that the evidence suggests, you know, we clearly urgently need.
Why is it called small world?
Well, because it is a small world. So everything that small world does is in some way a response to the fact that it's an increasingly small world in relation to the power of our species.
Not very long ago, it would have seemed enormous.
Yeah, that's right. So if you look at the way that we operate traditionally as a species, we understand the impacts that we can see in front of our eyes. So we're quite good at living in small communities. You know, no one in this room is likely to hit anybody else in the next few minutes, because we'd all be shocked by that, because we'd see it and we'd understand it. But we'd be much more likely to do something which has a much more indirect and diffuse negative impact around the world. We might do something which triggers a carbon footprint, for example, which causes you know, some emissions which have a diffuse impact, negative impact on 7 billion people spread over the next few years that we'll probably never understand. And so what we need to become much better at is tuning into that kind of abstract impact.
Do you have a favourite definition of sustainability?
I think we can get really bogged down in defining it. But it's one of those things we all kind of know what we mean, I think. So it's about being able to live well in a way that enables others to live well now and in the future.
That live well is a bit of a value statement in there.
Yeah, I don't want to get too deep into the philosophy of what we mean by a quality life. But
is how much of the problem is the overconsumption? We're trying to live too well.
Well, the overconsumption is a big part of the problem. But the reason we're doing it is, I guess we think it will enable us to live well, but most of the time, for us in the developed world, that's spurious. So it doesn't actually enable us to live well. One of the great opportunities for those of us who would like to see a more sustainable world is that almost all of us are spending a lot of time chasing the wrong things. So we're madly pursuing things that don't make us happy and don't make us healthy and do trash the planet. And if we could just free ourselves from that, life could be better on a lot of fronts.
What sort of things are we chasing that we shouldn't be?
Well, material stuff is a big part of it. Lots of us are working far harder than we need to. We are buying and doing things not because of their intrinsic enjoyment, but because we're sort of subconsciously hoping that that's some sort of, it will give us some sort of surrogate measure of our human worth. And of course, that's completely spurious.
And quite deeply embedded. Shopping is one of our major leisure activities.
Yeah, it's really deeply embedded. And I'm not going to pretend that that I'm free from this either. I think, I'm a human just like you are, just like all of us are. We all get trapped into this stuff. We're all susceptible to the cultural influences that surround us. And we'll all have a better time of it if we can break free a bit.
Okay, let's go back to the books. How bad are bananas? What prompted that?
Okay, well, when I first got into trying to help people, organisations of all kinds respond to climate change, I didn't think I'd get involved with any number crunching. I thought I would outsource that to people who could do the numbers on carbon, and I would just get involved in the organisational change stuff. And then I found, to my kind of shock really, that you couldn't go anywhere to get the numbers. There wasn't anybody doing a practical but robust job of supplying good enough management information, and I mean that to people or organisations, about just what were the carbon impacts of everything we do, the real full carbon impacts of everything we do. So I found my business getting into it, and then I wrote How Bad Are Bananas, because it was clear that we need this on an individual level as well. So, you know, How Bad Are Bananas is not about creating exact numbers, and it's not about, but it's designed to be something which gives you good enough, plausible, robust enough numbers, and it's trying to put them across in a way which is fun. It's in bite-sized chunks. It's supposed to be the kind of book that you can, you know, if you read books on the loo, you can keep it by the loo, you can put it by your bed as the last thing to read at night, you can dip into it, you can have fun with it, you don't have to cover to cover it. That's the intention behind it, and I think in some respects it works okay in that way.
Did it start out having a title about bananas? Is that the vision you had, or was that something developed?
No, it was going to be the carbon footprint of everything. It was going to be from bicycles to bananas. We were just playing around with alliterations and all kinds of things. And bananas came up because somebody said to me that bananas is one of the funniest words in the English language. It's almost impossible to say the word banana without a little bit of a smile coming onto your face. So that was kind of what I thought we'd better have. And also because How Bad Are Bananas? It's kind of an interesting question. Everybody assumes they're going to be awful because they come from the other side of the world, and in actual fact they come on a boat. So that, I mean, there are sustainability problems with bananas, but from a carbon point of view, they're great food.
So how did you go about finding out these things?
A whole lot of research, a whole lot of our own analysis, some macroeconomic modelling called input-output analysis that we got into, a whole load of stuff. I did a lot of work for us. All the stuff on food came out of my work for Booth Supermarkets, mapping out as best we could the carbon in all the supply chains of all the 35,000 products. Not with perfect accuracy, but with broad brush order of magnitude accuracy.
How far back do you go in those supply chains?
Oh, right to the theoretical infinite limit of them all. That's one of the great interesting questions about supply chains. So if there are two ways of trying to do it. One is called process-based life cycle analysis. And then when you're doing, and that's what people usually do, and when you do that, you map out the supply chain bit by bit, stage by stage, and you try and add up the carbon in all the different stages. But if you really think about it, the supply chain that comes off any physical object is infinite. The pathways are infinite. So, you know, you've got a tape recorder in front of you, and that was made in a factory, and in that factory there are components going into it, that's fine, but there are also all sorts of tertiary activities. There are people using computers just to run the accounts department, and those computers have supply chains coming off them because they have to be created every now and again. And if you track it, those supply chains go off, and there are an infinite number of infinitely long supply chains. And you could try and... Some people assume that if you just cover off the big chunks of the supply chain, you'll get most of it. And actually, because there's an infinite number of those other smaller supply chains, that's not obviously the case at all. Sometimes it is, and sometimes it's not. Sometimes I work for some clients whose supply chains are so complex that even if you took the direct emissions from the suppliers, the suppliers' suppliers, the suppliers' suppliers' suppliers, their suppliers, and then their suppliers again, you'd still only just about have half of it. And by that time, you've got billions of pathways already. So luckily, there's a piece of macroeconomic modelling called input-output analysis that has all kinds of generalities associated with it, but it gives you a technique for covering off all the supply chains, at least in a broad brush way, right to their infinite conclusion. It's a very smart piece of maths. And it doesn't give perfect answers. It's got all sorts of problems.
So what does it do? It tells you where it's okay to stop?
No, it does a piece of... it maps out the economy by industries. You attribute emissions to those industries, and then you map out the flows between the industries in financial terms. And then you do a neat piece of matrix algebra that boils down to solving some simultaneous equations. I didn't invent this myself. The result is that it is capable of tracking the supply chains all the way. Now, it makes all sorts of generic assumptions, so it doesn't have specific accuracy, but it has the massive advantage that it doesn't systematically underestimate. So if you use a combination of process-based methods and input-output-based methods, that's your best route to getting a credible answer within a finite resource.
So if you take everything and add them all up, do you end up with one, or is it...?
Yeah, if you use input-output analysis and you take the whole world's consumption and you work out the carbon footprint of it, you would get exactly the same number as you would get if you looked at all the emissions as they come out of the ground, as they come into the atmosphere through chimneys and factories and farms and all the rest of it. You'd get the same number. So that's the massive advantage. Whereas if you did the same through process-based life cycle analysis, you'd end up with, because of the systematic underestimation, because you've got to chop off the supply chains because you haven't got the resource to chase down them, you end up with a massive underestimation. And in some industries, that underestimation would be around 80%. In the telecommunications industry or something like that, be massive. In construction industry, we estimate to be something like 50%.
An 80% underestimation suggests
you're
not doing anything.
It's a bit of a showstopper. In food, it's because the emissions come from point sources like fields and a few places, you can do much better than that. So it works. Process-based analysis works better in some industries than others. So we use a mixture.
So I heard last week that the IT industry contributes 2%. Is that the right number, or is that an underestimation?
Well, it depends what you mean. So are you talking about the direct emissions from...
I don't know, they just
talk about the IT industry. I mean, it sounds plausible. I haven't, on the top of my head, got exact numbers, but we did in How Bad Are Bananas, we looked at things like the carbon footprint of the world's data centres. And we saw that by about now, data centres alone are going to be something like 0.5% of the world's footprint. Well, and rising really fast. Well, that's a pretty big deal. If you think that in the UK, paper has only ever been something like 1%. So we think that digitally storing information must be a great carbon saving. It must be a route to the low carbon world, surely. And if we stored the same amount of information as we always stored in the filing cabinets, then it would be. But the reality is that because it's millions of times more efficient, we store millions and millions of times more information. Not only that, but we've still got the filing cabinets as well. So it's a classic example of a really important effect, which is that efficiency improvements, which we assume are going to bring about less drain on resources and less environmental burden, end up producing increasing environmental burden. That's quite counterintuitive for many people, but it's a very important point for us. In fact, it's a critical point for us to get our heads around. So, and the evidence for this is extremely strong. I mean, just think about it. So if you track, this is moving on to the burning question a little bit, a second book. So if you track greenhouse gas emissions from energy use in the world since 1850, you find a mathematically exponential rising curve. It's been going up at 1.8% per year for the last 160 years, with precious little deviation from that year on year. Occasionally you get a few good years, but they're always followed by a few bad years. And so you've got this exponential growth, and it's pretty impervious to resilient to any changes that we think we might impose on it. So we can have world wars, we can have great depressions, we can discover massive oil fields in the Middle East, we can have an OPEC crisis. Some of those things create short-term dents, but we bounce back from them back onto this exponential curve. And you can do the maths and the stats on that curve, and it really is mathematically exponential with hardly any deviation. And that leads you to say, well, what's going on here in the global dynamics? Because we all know people who've done things to try and bring about a low-carbon world and who won't fly, and countries with targets to cut their emissions and stuff. And so surely you'd see some sort of dent in the curve. And you don't see any, not the faintest trace of a dent, not anything. And that tells us some incredibly important things. But one of the things it tells us is that efficiency gains, by default, don't bring about a reduction in the total burden. So if you think back since 1850, I mean, in 1850, how inefficient were we compared to now? If you wanted to read a book at night, or have a light source at night in 1850, the only way you could do it was to set fire to something. Was the only way you could have light at night. And now we've got LED light bulbs and all kinds of things that are something like 500 times more efficient. But you know what? The carbon footprint of our lighting has gone up, not down. And that's because we can have more of it. And because we can read at night so much more easily now, we can do more things at night, we can aspire to more at night, we can invent more things at night, we can create more wherewithal to go and dig fossil fuel out of the ground. So our whole capacity for everything goes up. But our appetite doesn't go down. Our appetite goes disproportionately higher. And you can ask all sorts of questions. Sometimes people say, well, is that just because the population's gone up? And actually, it's not. That's very interesting. Population has gone up, but not exponentially. And in countries, you can see lots of countries where the population has tailed off, including our own. But the point at which population growth tails off, that is exactly the same point at which the emissions per person steepens. At the point at which people have less children, that's the same point at which the impact that each person has gets even more steeper. So we don't have less children to reduce the environment. We absorb. By having less kids, we in our own lives absorb the impact that our kids would have had, is one way of looking at it.
Because we then start having second cars and...
Yeah, we've got more money to fly to the Caribbean for our holidays or whatever it is. So, the way the dynamics works is that, you know, population has risen, but not exponentially. GDP per person has risen in all kinds of ways, not mathematically exponentially. The carbon efficiency of our energy has generally improved. The last decade's an exception; it's got worse, but has generally improved. But if you add all these things together, it's only when you multiply all those things together that you get mathematically exponential carbon emissions curve. So, and that is an astonishingly simple reality that has passed by policymakers and politicians the world over. And that's the reason why Duncan Clark and I wrote The Burning Question. That's the single biggest reason, was because it became clear, it was clear to us that there was some astonishingly simple, uncontestable science, which was so important that you couldn't hope to get on top of the climate change problem without integrating it properly and hard into the psyche and thinking of anyone making important decisions on this agenda. And yet, it was passing us right by. And it accounted for why we are getting nowhere on climate change.
But before we even get on to the science lessons for dealing with it, we've also got the science lessons, the fact that big chunks of people don't even think that climate change is a problem.
Well, that's true. So the burning question is a big picture perspective on climate change, and it's a multidisciplinary look at climate change. Because if climate change was just a bit of science and politics and technology, we'd have solved it by now. Our species is good at solving that kind of problem, but it's not. Climate change is probably the most fascinating as well as the most pressing puzzle that our species has ever had to deal with. And it's much more than science and politics. It's about psychology and sociology and culture, and it's probably inescapably about art as well. It's about the whole how do human beings function as a 7 billion unit on a small planet. And it doesn't work to try to solve the problem in a silo. So we know from the IPCC, for example, that there are thousands of highly intelligent, thoughtful, competent scientists out there who've created what you'd think would be a bulletproof evidence base, at least not about the detail of how climate change is panning out, but at least to tell us in no uncertain terms and without doubt that it's a problem we need to be taking extremely seriously. And yet, most people...
But we insist on wrapping it up with uncertainty terms, which people think, oh, well, maybe it's not happening then.
Well, the problem is... The problem is the human psychology of all this. So we're good at facing up to some pressing, difficult problem. So, you know, if I were to punch you on the nose right now, everyone in this room would suddenly wake up to a big problem and we all would start dealing with it in one way or another. But climate change is abstract. It's about this invisible gas. It's about there's a whole lot of difficult science you need to get on top of in order to understand what's going on. It's got uncertainty, and uncertainty makes us uncomfortable. And it's a problem about the future, probably. Increasingly, it's a problem about now, but it's primarily a problem about the future. So we have to start tuning into what's going to be happening in 40 years' time, thinking about our kids in ways that we're not used to getting so far into the future. And also, somehow we need to tune into other people on the other side of the world who we're never going to meet personally, who are never going to know that you or I personally exist. And we're going to have to start caring about them in the same way that we care about our own family and people in our own street. And that is... all those elements of the problem have completely caught us off balance. And our normal ways of dealing with problems, our habitual ways of doing science, communicating science, doing politics, doing economics, all of that stuff has been unfit for purpose and has been shown to be lacking in its ability to help us get on top of the climate change problem. So we need to invent new processes, new ways of thinking, new ways of, you know, this university needs, you know, and all universities need to find new ways of getting science out into the politics, because there's a disconnect.
We spoke to Naomi Oreskes last year. She was the person that declared the consensus, essentially, on climate change. And she said two things that stick in my mind. One of them is that we're almost been undone by the fact that we were so successful at fixing ozone. Because it was a simple fix, and people sort of like put it in the same, we just need to figure out what that fix is and then do it. And the other thing that she points out is that it's so counter to sort of free market economics that's not going to fix it. And so that's why we've got the sort of huge backlash against it, because it's against that other agenda.
I think our the way we dealt with the ozone layer was encouraging in that it involved a lot of international cooperation and so on. However, it's not the same kind of problem as climate change, because there was not the same threat to vested interest, and it didn't require the same reworking of the same fundamental reworking of so much of our economic fabric. So, you know, there was some threat and some opportunity to the business world, I'm sure, but nothing like the threat and opportunity that exists to, you know, the threat to the fossil fuel industry, and yet, and this is often passed by, enormous opportunity to huge chunks of the business world. If you're in the telecommunications industry or any industry that's in the business of providing efficient utility, you know, such as teleconferencing or something like that, then a carbon constrained world is a massive opportunity for you, actually. But it was easy to deal with the ozone problem without reinventing or making any fundamental changes to the basic way that we do economics. And one of the great questions is, to what extent is our current economic model broken and unfit for purpose? And my experience of this, and we talk about this a bit in The Burning Question, is that most people knee-jerk to one or the other end of a spectrum. So some people go straight to the end of the spectrum that says that the way we do economics has to be taken as a given, and you can't change that, and anyone who thinks you can is being totally unrealistic and they're in cuckoo land, and we have to have economic growth in the way that we've always understood it, and we have to have blah 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 blah, and that's just how it has to be. And there are other people who think that all of that has always been the root of all evil anyway, and we need to get away from it in any case, and climate change just gives us one more reason why we should. And what Duncan and I ended up saying was that actually this needs a much more balanced and detailed discussion. But two things are clear. One is, although we've never managed to achieve economic growth without increasing our environmental burden in the past, actually it's unproven that we couldn't do that if we wanted to with... if we had a global cap on carbon coming out of the ground, for example, which we've absolutely got to have, that's a must have, then it's unproven whether we or not we could have economic growth. We probably could. It's only, you know, economic GDP is only a human construct.
So you're saying, would there be no more, like, stopping or just limiting how much we take out?
Well, what the science tells us is that there is, and there are no hard and fast cutoffs over this, but we need to cap the total amount of carbon that ever comes out of the ground. And we're not far off our limit on that. We're only a decade or two. We're only a couple of decades away on our current trajectory from reaching that limit for a best estimate of probably staying within 2 degrees temperature rise. And because the curve's exponential and we're doubling not only our rate of emissions, but also the cumulative emissions that there's ever been about every 39 years at the moment. You know, we'll very rapidly, if we go past the 2 degrees and stay on the trajectory, we'll very rapidly go up to two, commit ourselves to 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and, you know, and all the rest of it. So we absolutely need to have urgently a cap on the carbon that ever comes out of the ground. And we could do that with a falling trajectory with a per year limit, but it must be rapidly declining. So we've got to have that.
So is that the subtitle here? We can't burn half the world's oil, coal and gas.
Yeah.
So that's of known reserves now. We can only burn half of it. Is that the...
No, actually half is... we didn't get the strapline as smart as we might have. You can't, depending on how much you want to throw the dice, we can't burn half. You know, you could maybe burn... It depends what you count as the world's coal and gas. The proven reserves, that's the stuff that's already on the books. The oil companies are pretty well committed to selling it mm-hmm. for money profitably. We can burn something like half of that. But if you look at the total extractable fuel in the ground, then we can only burn a tiny proportion of it. If you look at the total known resources, that's the stuff that we know is down there and it's possible to get it out of the ground, then we can only burn a minuscule proportion of that. And don't forget that all the time we're bringing on new technologies and we're discovering new fields, and we're bringing on new technologies for getting the hard-to-reach stuff out of the ground. So fracking, shale gas, all that stuff is... and it is an example of that. So if we just, some people say, well, yeah, maybe fuel scarcity will get us out of this problem on its own. And the answer to that is no chance.
Why not?
There's just far too much of it, and we're far too good at getting it out of the ground. So we are going to have to voluntarily, as a species, we're going to have to voluntarily commit to leaving it in the ground, which means the fuel companies have to write off their... assets.
Well, that's not going to happen.
Well, let's have a look. If you are a fuel company and your business strategy is to sell fossil fuel, then your position is similar to being a tobacco company trying to get people to smoke as many cigarettes as possible. And your only route is to try and dodge the legislation, delay the legislation, pull the wool over as many people's eyes for as long as you can. And that's the kind of business you're going to have to be. If you are, and I was speaking to one of the UK's big energy suppliers recently about this, if you're in the business of providing utility for households, for example, so that people can be warm and comfortable, then that's a very different proposition. That allows you to move away from fossil fuels. It allows you to encourage people to be efficient in their households. It allows you to invest hard in other energy sources. And it gives you a pathway, at least in theory. There's a lot of detail to work through, but it gives you a pathway by which you can be a thriving business contributing to a sustainable world. So there is a route through for the fossil fuel guys. But if you're in another industry, like, I don't know, in the UK, British Telecom, or if you're in IT, or a whole host of other industries, a carbon-constrained world gives you stacks of opportunity. A global carbon constraint would change the value of all kinds of products and services. And if you were in the business of enabling people to have more utility through less use of resource, then you would be a pig in shit. And that case is only just being grasped by big corporations, just starting to be grasped. And it does require imagination to see what it requires some vision to see how that's going to pan out. But there are plenty of big corporations out there who should be pushing for a global deal on carbon emissions, on carbon extraction, like crazy, if for no other reason than it's a business opportunity.
We seem to be stuck, though, on that not happening.
Yeah.
Everybody went off to Copenhagen with great hopes and came back disappointed.
Yeah. The psychology of human denial is... fascinating, and we understand it quite well. We understand it in terms of sort of human grief, and on a personal level, we've got quite a good understanding of the mechanics. The processes the brain goes through to first of all put off having to deal with difficult news, and finally to get its head around it, and then finally to respond in a positive way to it, and how you can help individuals through that process. And if you apply that to climate change, the same sort of things are going on. Quite clearly the same sort of things are going on. But the difficulty is that there are so many ways, new ways, in which we can put off the bad news. So, if your loved one dies on you, there is a hard reality there. The evidence is so clear and strong that eventually you're going to know it's happened, no matter how hard your brain is trying to wriggle out of it. Climate change isn't like that. There's a lot more wriggle room. It's abstract. It's going to be going on a few years' time.
And it's not starting next Tuesday.
It's not starting next Tuesday. You've got scientists and politicians and business leaders and £1 billion a year worth of lobby funding going on to create a whole storyline to help persuade you that you can put this off, you know, for another day. And even if you accept the facts, you've still got a whole rack of excuses for why there's nothing you can do, or it's not your problem, or it's somebody else who should be doing it. It's really down to the politicians or the consumers or the businesses or people in other countries. Maybe it's the Chinese or the Americans, or everybody's got a reason why it's not them that has to do anything about it. So we've got all these layers and layers of defences between the evidence and the hard reality that all of us have an important and urgent role in confronting the issue right now, and we can all do something about it.
So we talked about what is a big business opportunity rather than a threat, hopefully, for those companies. But what about the smaller scales of individuals?
Well, I'll come on to that in a sec. Just back to the business opportunity. I don't want to be... I actually think there is a lot of business opportunity out there. I also don't think it's the root reason why businesses should change what they do. I think we should be absolutely clear and unembarrassed about this. The reason why we as people and as individual and as businesses and as countries should respond to climate change and sustainability is because it's the right thing to do. Full stop. We should be unembarrassed about that. You know, whether or not it's the most profitable thing to do, we should do it because it's the right thing, because we care about our kids. And they'll look us in the eye and ask us what we did about it. Or even if they're too embarrassed to do that, they'll wonder. They'll want us to have done the right thing.
Do you think in 50 years' time people are going to look back and think, what were they thinking?
Yeah, I do. And I think they'll have every right to. They will look at, you know, the children of people whose parents and grandparents were in nasty regimes. You know, they will look back and they will say, why? What were you doing? How they'll wonder at how we got swept along. They'll wonder at our inaction. And they'll be disappointed by it. And we won't like that. We won't like that feeling. When we know that the question is somewhere, whether it's being tangibly asked or whether it's just quietly lurking in the background, we'll know that the question is there. When you saw climate change fully in the face, what did you do about it? You know, did you really just carry on because you couldn't think of anything to do, or because you weren't brave enough, or because everyone else around you was just carrying on? Were you really that weak? I think we'd all be embarrassed to think of ourselves as being like that.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
I wouldn't say that I take a sort of perfect line on this. I roll my sleeves up in some ways. I try and target my efforts. I could always do more. I think it's really important to... you have to find a way of responding to climate change and the whole sustainability thing, agenda, that works personally. Because if not... nobody will want to follow you in what you do, for a start, so it won't be effective. And so it's quite a good litmus test. If your lifestyle has turned rubbish, you're not enjoying life, you're going around being resentful, then you're probably going about it all the wrong way. There's something about this psychology you haven't got your head on. So you need to find a way of responding properly to this agenda in a way that also works personally. And that is difficult. And I think to myself, you know what, the person who works out how to do that will have an answer that will be, will have an approach to this that will be so infectious that we'll get it. You know, our species will get it when that happens.
Do you think younger people are coming through having got it? Or are they on the same trajectory?
I think there are younger people out there who are getting it. In fact, we've got a couple of interns in the office right now who are in that boat, and they're smiling in an embarrassed kind of way, but they're on the case, and they'll get answers that we haven't got. You know, they'll see things now that, you know, I'm sure Murta will see stuff that, you know, that I will never see. because that's what the younger generation does, don't they? They create, they find solutions to stuff that the older generation can't get their head around. So thank goodness, they better get a move on though.
What motivates you?
Anyone who thinks about it wants to be constructive in their life, don't they? Anyone who pauses to think about it wants to be constructive. And I suppose something about the way my brain works is that I tend to see the big picture in some ways better than I see the little details. So once you see the big picture, and I tend to kind of hang on to it. So I think that takes me into sustainability stuff, because when you look at the big picture, it's pretty hard to ignore sustainability as a big deal.
What challenges do you have for the next couple of years?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I think, you know, the burning question takes me to a very clear understanding of some pretty uncontestable, very fundamentally important realities. So, just to recap, we've got to urgently cap the fuel coming out of the ground. Efficiency on its own won't help us because of rebound effects and so on. The dynamic is that the more efficient we get at things, the more we consume. Renewables on their own won't help us, not on their own, for the same reasons. And the biggest crunch in all this is the gap between the evidence base and the action at all levels, personal, political, business, all the rest of it. It's that psychology of how do we overcome that gap. And it's all too easy to collude in that, in just being part of the problem, doing things that look like they're great, but if you really look at what's their contribution to creating the conditions under which we'll leave the fuel in the ground, you find that it doesn't actually make a perceptible contribution. So I think where I'm at is I am looking at what are the best ways of bridging that gap between the evidence and the action. So I'm looking at exciting new ways of engaging business. How do you really get the top teams in energy companies to engage with this agenda in a way that's commensurate with the evidence? How do you get politicians to feel able to engage with this in a way that's commensurate with the evidence? What's the role of an individual? Because, and you asked me this earlier, I said I'd come back to it. You know, what can any of us do? Even if you're Barack Obama, you're still a speck in the global system. What can any of us do to be meaningfully part of creating the conditions under which the world leaves its fuel in the ground? And it's about leadership, and it's about understanding the systemic impact of everything we do. So I could choose not to fly, but someone else will take my flight and the rebound effects will happen and it won't in itself directly make the world a better place. I could choose not to fly, have a fantastic local holiday, and everybody sees that I've had a great time having a fantastic local holiday, and then they want one too. And then I could run my whole life in a different way and have more fun while I'm at it and encourage others to do it. I was at a supermarket chain that I do a lot of work with recently, and we were talking about how much meat people eat, and we were talking about the whole, because it's clear the world needs to eat less red meat. And this is a very aspirational supermarket. And if they can help their customers to aspire to a lower meat diet, not because it's worthy, but because it feels good for all kinds of reasons, because it looks so appetizing, it's so healthy, maybe because it's more affordable, and actually maybe quietly because it's more sustainable too. If that can be what the customers of that supermarket aspire to and achieve, my goodness, the rising middle class in China will start aspiring to it as well, because they want exactly what.
Do all those little things add up? I mean, I'm thinking about things like what's the carbon impact of farmers' markets and localization. It's trivial, if anything, but does it add up?
All those things add up if they create meaningful cultural change. Yeah. And I think, I mean, I could get, it's possible to get quite bogged down and depressed about the state we're all in, because it's clear that we need a lot of change and we do need it pretty fast. But I could also get quite optimistic, because I think the way that things can change is by systemic tipping point. The conditions will suddenly become right, not just politically. It'll be a blend of politics and culture and science and technology, and all the pieces in the pie will come together in one go, and suddenly we'll realize that we don't have to be trapped into this exponential trajectory. We can do something differently. And those conditions will have come about by all sorts of small things that look as though they're nothing. They look as though they're beating your head against the wall. They all look as though they're pinpricks in this enormous global dynamic that's just taking us down the wrong road. But they'll add up together, and suddenly it'll start feeling like things are beginning to move a little bit. And I think a fairly well-founded hope that tipping points happen, and historically have often happened very, very fast. And there can be a very small period of time in between seeing the first signs of things actually starting to tip to suddenly, wow, we're in a different game altogether.
In a sort of a concrete level, is there a number? Do we need to get 15, 20% of people cycling? Can we set goals on...
No, we can't. Well, I know some people think goals really help us and stuff, and you can have goals around targets around climate emissions and all the rest of it, but they're all spurious in a way. I mean, it's all about probabilities and uncertainties, and, you know, we can invent these hard numbers, and they're useful up to a point. They give us some kind of gauge, but the reality is, if there are hard and fast cutoffs of, you know, climate tipping points, what's the point at which there's so much carbon up there? There's nothing we can do to have just a massive positive feedback thing. You know, we don't know when those points are going to, when are we going to cross those thresholds? So there's not really much. In a way, it's spurious to have those targets. You asked me about how many people cycle. Well, the more the merrier. But, you know, if one person does something more sustainable that's a bit unusual, then the next person who's wondering whether to do it or not, well, at least they won't feel like quite such a loony, because they know someone else who did it. And so, you know, it gathers momentum. And it's shocking how much we all like to be like everybody else. I mean, you know, I like to think of myself as an individual, but just like everybody, we're all driven far more by...
And having the infrastructure to help us do those things which become normalised. So,
yeah.
At Lancaster University, there's a really, really nice cycleway from here into the city. That yes. must help enormously.
Yeah, that does. That really helps. And there's been a nice, you know, on the minus side, there's been a nice piece of research come out recently just looking at, you know, quantifying the emissions that we're committed to if all the recently built coal power stations get used for their full life. So that's, you know, that's an example of it going the wrong way. But anyone who's building a house, for example, or has anything to do with any infrastructure investment, sure, that's an opportunity.
If you could wave a magic wand and wake up tomorrow and a miracle's happened, what would it be?
Well, I suppose this isn't quite a miracle, but I suppose Paris 2015 climate summit, we have to think that is an opportunity. So the miracle I'd have between now and the start of that summit is that the conditions would be created for world leaders to go to that, knowing that their careers depended on getting progress that is commensurate with the scientific evidence. There we go. Is that a miracle?
Well, it's nice to have something that's not an actual miracle, but something that we can say, okay, let's make that happen. Given my next question is, do you have any advice for listeners?
Think out of the box. Think really differently. Think really differently about how you live, what makes you happy. Go right back to first principles. Think about, break out of and challenge all the constraints about how we have to do life. Because we can have tons more fun than we're currently having by being more sustainable. And there's no doubt about that. I mean, I wish I was better at practicing what I preach myself, but, you know, there's no doubt that there's opportunity in that. This is not a doom and gloom agenda. This is a let's have a party agenda.
And with that, plans for a party note, thank you very much. You've been listening to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher and me, Samuel Mann. We're broadcast on Otago Access Radio, oar.org.nz, and podcast on sustainablelens.org. On sustainablelens.org, we're building up a searchable archive of conversation with people from many different fields who are applying their skills to a sustainable future. In our conversations, we try to find out what motivates them and what it means to see the world through a sustainable perspective, through their sustainable lens. Today's sustainable lens has been Mike Berners-Lee, the director of Small World Consulting and the author of How Bad Are Bananas and The Burning Question. You can follow the links on sustainablelens.org to find us in various places, including on Facebook, to keep in touch, and you can listen to Sustainable Lens via iTunes as well. That was Sustainable Lens. I'm Samuel Mann, and I hope you enjoyed the show.
This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.